if you can't usually saturate it, it's actually even in most cases not very tight. So it's well, it's useful as a bound, but it's certainly not the final word on such things. I mean, if you go out and actually work really hard to try to find codes, you won't be able to come very close to it. So it'd be nice to have some techniques that would give you better guidance as to when you're actually going to be able to find the code. And so what I'm going to talk about now is a set of such techniques. These are called linear programming bounds, because what you do is you get a bunch of linear equations and inequalities, and then if you can find a solution to those, then it's possible that a code could exist. And if you can't find a solution, then you know a code can't. So how is this going to work? Well, we're going to start by defining weight enumerators. So let's start just with stable logic codes. So the weight enumerator is going to be some polynomial. There's going to be n qubits, as usual here. And some polynomial. So we sum over j equals 0 to n. We have some coefficient a sub j, x to the j. And this coefficient a sub j is going to be the number, the stabilizer code s, the number of elements of weight j in s. Okay? So a sub j seems like a very sensible thing to look at. It's not clear what it's going to tell us, but at least it's telling us something about the stabilizer. Okay? And the x is just kind of this dummy variable, and the different powers of x we just use to index different values of j. So if you've done much combinatorics, you're familiar with the kind of things. If you haven't, hopefully it's still not too hard to figure out what's going on. Okay. This is just a mathematical object that's going to kind of encode all this information about the different weights of elements of s. Okay. So what's the other interesting thing in the stabilizer? The interesting thing about a stabilizer code. Well, instead of s, we can look at n of s. So what we can do is define a dual weight enumerator, or the dual enumerator. And we'll call that b of x. And it's defined basically the same way. Except that it's the number of elements of weight j in n of s. Okay? And what's going to happen is there's going to be a relationship between these two things. Between these two polynomials. And that's going to give us one set of these bounds. Okay, so before I define that, let's generalize beyond stabilizer codes. Well, not specifically for non-stabilizer, but for general quantum fractal codes. Well, we define these polynomials the same way, except we have to define the aj and bj differently. Okay, so we're going to do that in terms of the projector onto the code. And so this is going to be an N big K code. Remember that big K is can be equal to 2 to the little k. But this is not going to be restricted to things that are power of 2 in size. And so trace on of pi is equal to big K. Okay, because pi in appropriate basis looks like 1s for the k dimensions of the code and 0 elsewhere. Okay, and then when we do this, a sub j is equal to 1 over k squared, the sum trace p pi squared. So what is this sum? Well, okay, so first of all, let Pn bar equals the Pauli group modulo phases. So it's kind of just the what you get when you, for instance, go to this binary vector form. So it's just the kind of basic x, y, and z or tensor products. And so the sum is going to be over P in Pn, but not all P's, just the ones where the weight P is equal to J. Okay? So this is well,
you're in Pn bar.
Pn bar. It's the whole point of defining it. So this is kind of telling you the amount of the weight JP's that's in this projector. And that's why it's going to correspond to this to the weight enumerator in the stabilizer code case. Well, it's still called the weight enumerator. This is why it's corresponding to the number of elements in S. I'll show you that in a minute, how it's equal. Okay. And then so this is the square of the trace, and BJ is basically going to be the trace of the square. So it's 1 over k times the sum over the same thing, p in pn bar, with weight p equal to j, of trace p pi p pi. Okay? And then a of x, b of x are defined just the same way. It's sum of aj f to the j, sum of bj f to the j. Okay. So how do we see that these are the same, at least in the stabilizer code case? Hopefully you have a better angle to see those than I do. So for stabilizer code, what's the projector on the code subspace? Well, that's something we did way back a couple weeks ago. So it's basically the sum over elements in the stabilizer. And then you have to normalize by the number of elements in the stabilizer. So that's 2 to the n minus k. And the other thing to bear in mind, since we're going to be taking traces of things, so this doesn't depend on being a stabilizer code, but if you take Q that's in the Pauli group, or in this case, in this kind of restricted Pauli group, then trace Q is equal to 0 unless Q is equal to the identity. So if Q is equal to the identity, it's non-zero. And what is the trace then? Well, it's 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix, identity matrix. So that's 2 to the n. OK. So then let's evaluate A sub j using this formula. So we get 1 over k squared, where big K is now 2 to the little k. So it's 2 to the 2k times the sum over p of trace p pi squared. Well, what is trace p pi? Well, plugging in this formula for pi, we get 1 over 2 to the n minus k sum over m and s trace p times f. But this, m is a Pauli operator, p is a Pauli operator. So this product, the trace of this product, is 0 unless p is equal to m. Or I guess m is equal to p. But of course, it's only possible if p is in the stabilizer, right? So in the case where p is in the stabilizer, well, then, well, okay, in the case where p is not in the stabilizer, that's easier. That means that this is always going to be equal to 0, so this sum is 0. Okay, the case where p is in the stabilizer, well, then this is 0 except for the case where m is equal to p. So there's only one term that's interesting here. And that term, well, we get a factor of 2 to the n up there. So 2 to the n over 2 to the n minus k gives us a 2 to the k here. But actually, of course, it might be that the one thing I did do wrong is that this is only true when q is in pn bar. Since m is in the stabilizer, it's actually in pn, so it could be plus or minus times p, and it still had this work. So if neither plus or minus p is in the stabilizer, plus or minus p, then we get plus or minus 2 to the k. But of course, that doesn't matter when we go up here because we're going to square it. And so this is equal to 1 over 2 to the 2k times, well, every time we have a p that's in the stabilizer, we get a factor of 2 to the 2k in here. Right? So 2 to the 2k. And every time we have a p that's not in the stabilizer, we just get 0. So this sum is over p's of weight equal to j. So we get this 2 to the 2k times the number of elements of s of weight j. Right, and of course, that's what we said before. Okay? Are you ready to see that? Okay. So for b, we have to evaluate something else. We have to evaluate trace of this quantity, p pi, p pi. First, let's actually just look at p pi p. So what is this equal to? So we have sum, well, 1 over 2 to the n minus k, sum over m and s, p, m, p, right? Which is 1 over 2 to the n minus k, sum over, well, if p and m commute, then we can just move this p through and it cancels itself. If p and m anti-commute, then when we move it through, we get a minus sign. So this minus 1 is to the symplectic product of p and m. We get plus 1 if they commute, minus 1 if they anti-commute. Okay? So this thing is a projector on, well, not the original stabilizer code, but a stabilizer code with different eigenvalues for things. So in particular, there's two interesting cases. So in the case where p is actually an n of s, so it commutes with everything in the stabilizer, we do, in fact, get the original projector back. Right? And when P is not in the original stabilizer, well, then some of them will get minus signs. If that means that we're in our projector on a different code subspace, that's orthogonal to the original code space. And in fact, P minus pi minus pi is equal to zero, because as I said, they're orthogonal subspaces. So what that means is that if we look at trace P pi, well, we have two possibilities. If, again, if P is in N of S, then P pi P is equal to pi, and we just get trace pi squared, since pi is projected, that's just pi again. And trace of pi is equal to 2 to the k. But if P is not in N of S, then we get trace of pi minus pi, which is 0. So the upshot of this is that in this formula up there for B of J, we have 1 over 2 to the k sum of trace p pi p pi. Well, that's equal to, well, the sum cancels out the things that aren't in N of S. But it's a sum over the things in N of S times 2 to the k. So it's just, again, the number elements of N of S, but we're just summing over the things of weight j. So it's just a number of things in N of S of weight j. Okay? So that tells you how these two definitions are connected. Okay? Questions so far?
This piece was pi minus.
Oh, so pi minus is this thing. In the case where P anti-commutes with something, so there's sum minus sum. So it's a projector on a subspace which looks like the original code space but has some different eigenvalues. Other questions? Okay, moving on. I guess I have to erase something now. Okay, so now we're ready to actually get to these linear programming guides. So first a couple of properties. About these A's and B's. So first a very easy one. A0 and B0, they're both 1. Okay? So in the stabilizer code case, well, why is that? It's number of things of weight 0, that's just the identity. And that's in both S and N of S. In the non-stabilizer code case, it's still pretty easy. Because, well, we're summing over things of weight 0. So that's the identity. So we're just taking trace of pi squared, which, of course, is equal to trace of pi is equal to k. So that's k squared. It just cancels. So that's A sub 0. B sub 0, similarly, we have 1 over k trace of pi squared, with the square inside the parentheses. So again, just 1. Okay, so that's really easy to prove. What's a little bit harder is this one. Bj greater than or equal to aj is greater than or equal to 0. So the stabilizer code case, this is also really obvious, right? So clearly they both have to be greater than or equal to zero because you can't have the number of elements be negative. And S, the stabilizer, is included in N of S. So clearly BJ is always going to be at least as big as AJ. The non-stabilizer code case needs a teeny bit of work to prove it. It's not terribly hard, but... So anyway, so this is one set of constraints on A and B. But there's another one which depends on the distance. And again, it's easy to see this in the stabilizer code case, but it requires a little bit of work to prove it in the general case. And that's, so if we have a quantum error correcting code, and the distance of that code is d, then A sub j is equal, in fact, to B sub j for j less than d. Okay? So again, for the stabilizer code, that's just saying that for things of weight less than d, if they're an n of s, they must also be an s. Right? So that's our original definition of distance in the case of a stabilizer code. Right? That n of s minus s has no elements of weight less than d. So all this is saying is that when we have these generalized weight enumerators, that still has to be true. So the case where AJ is equal to BJ, but they're non-zero, that's kind of an interesting case, right? That's like what we had before of a degenerate code. So for stabilizer code, remember, if we had things of weight less than d in N of s, but they didn't cause this problem because they were actually in S. That was a degenerate code, right? Because that indicated that there were two errors of low weight whose product was trivial. So two errors of low weight which did the same thing on the code words. But in the general case, this property is a slightly different one. So... So code where these things are equal to zero, for k less than d, is called pure code. And otherwise it's impure. So in the case of stabilizer code, impure and degenerate are the same thing. But in the general case, they don't have to be. And so in fact, the way I remember it is, well, you can be impure without being degenerate. But if you're degenerate, well, then you're certainly impure. So degenerate implies impure, but not vice versa. Okay? So that's just kind of a side note in your context. So again, this is the terminology you'll sometimes see in the literature. Okay. Okay, so here's the linear programming back, the first one. So this, as I said, sets one set of constraints on the AJs and the BJs. And this next thing sets up the relationship between the two polynomials A and B. This theorem called the quantum McWilliams identity. You may be noticing a theme in the way these things are named. Okay, the classical identity and stick the word quantum in front of it. And what this says is that the polynomial B of x is equal to big K over 2 to the n 1 plus 3x to the n, a 1 minus x, 1 plus 3x. Okay, so this is the argument that you plug this variable for the variable this expression. Okay? And so this sets the relationship between the AJs and the BJs. And combined with these properties, that's going to set up a bunch of constraints on these AJs and BJs that, well, sometimes you'll be able to satisfy them for some parameters NKP, and sometimes you won't. Okay? And if we have a quantum error corrected code, then you can go through this machinery and you'll get a set that satisfies them. So you know if you can't satisfy those constraints, then a code can't exist. Okay? So sometimes this alone is enough to give you interesting properties. But for the best balance, we actually need another such identity. Which I will foolishly try to fit on the same blackboard. So the quantum shadow enumerator is called. Another polynomial, it's equal to, so it's defined in a similar way, except it looks a little funny. It has sum is equal to 1 over k times the sum over the same thing as before, p and p n bar, wait, p equals j. But now we're taking, it looks a little like b. We have trace p pi p, but then we stick in a y tensor n, pi star, and another y tensor n. So pi star is the complex conjugate of the projector. So you see that this is a basis-dependent definition. It's basis-dependent in two ways. First of all, the complex conjugate is a basis-dependent thing. And y is a basis-dependent thing. If you change basis, you'll get a different y. Okay, so you have to be consistent in both of these. If you change basis, I think you'll get a different value for these s and for these j's. You have the possibility of getting different values. But I think in the end, you have to get the same constraints. I'm not positive about that. Okay, so this is just some formula you can plug in. Given a code, you can plug this in and get these quantities. Okay, and the relevant theorem, well, looks a little bit like the ones we had before. So first of all, we have that the shadow enumerator coefficients are non-negative. And we have a thing that relates the shadow enumerator to A. So since the shadow enumerator looks a lot like B, this is going to be very similar to this quantum Williams identity, with only one difference. And that difference is instead of having 1 minus x here, we have x minus 1. So this has the effect of basically changing when you expand A, instead of having, you'll change the sign of the odd coefficients in A. We'll see that in a minute.
The power almost disappears.
Yes. Right, thanks. Okay. So this sets up another set of constraints, and when you satisfy try to solve both of these constraints at once, obviously you're more restricted than before. And using these two, this sets most of the upper bounds that we know on quantum codes.
Does that last identity have a
facility
name as well?
No, I don't think so. But obviously, it's the object it's doing has a silly name, quantum kappa integrated. In some ways, even more silly, because I'm pretty sure it's not named after a person. Or maybe that's less silly, I don't know. It's a matter of perspective. I'm not sure why it's called the shadow of the brain. Other questions? Well, okay, so so clearly A of X and B of X were sensible things to look at, right? The A sub J and B sub J in the case of stabilizer code had some great meaning.
Does that make sense?
The fact that you have this relationship, well, I don't know how they figured that out.
But it has to be first of all the AJ and BJ indicated the non
Oh, well, I mean, the motivation, so I don't know how they came up with these exact formulas, but obviously you want to come up with something that's going to reduce to the stabilizer code versions, and that's what they are. It's not too surprising. I mean, if you look at some general pi, you can expand it as a sum of polymatrices, right? Because polymatrices span all possible matrices. And so trace p pi is then the coefficient of p in that expansion. Okay, so that trace p pi is kind of a useful quantity to bear in mind. And then when, so basically then aj and bj are kind of second order polynomials in this in these coefficients. Bj obviously is a little more complicated, some kind of correlation thing between different coefficients. But it's in roughly the same family. So in fact you can form higher order polynomials with p and pi and still get interesting things that way. Or you can use like trace p pi, trace q pi, another interesting thing. Things like that. And you can find interesting things about codes by looking at these things. Yeah.
So that means why do you, so what is the distribution for putting, I mean, pi is a projector, right?
Yeah.
So pi star is pi.
No. Pi star is the complex conjugate. So the projector, in some basis, might not be real. I mean, obviously, if you diagonalize it, it'll be just ones and zeros. But in some other basis, it might have complex coefficients. It just has to be Hermitian.
But trace is basis independent.
Trace is basis independent. But the combination of the star and the y, since both of these are basis dependent things, you can get something interesting this way.
So suppose we are in the basis in which pi is diagonal. Right?
Okay. Yeah, you can
then
do
you
that.
Can replace pi star with pi.
In that basis, that's right.
But then trace is basically.
Yeah, but the y still is not. I mean, sorry. I mean, I'm not quite sure what you're getting at.
Okay, so since trace of AB is trace of BA, we can put the last white insert n in front, right? Let's say.
Okay.
Okay, and then we call the entire matrix is let's say some A. Right?
Okay.
A pi star.
Okay.
Okay. Now A pi star, if you look it in the basis in which pi star is diagonal, right? Pi is diagonal. Then it's equal to trace A pi.
Yes.
Right?
But the point is that A would be different in that case, right? You can't choose, because the y's, as you change basis, this has to be y in that basis, in the same basis as you're taking this complex conjugate. So A changes to something different. It's not just the basis change of A. It's something different when you do that, when you change basis for pi.
So y is always that particular matrix, not quite.
Yes, it's the actual y of the Pauli matrix in the appropriate basis that you're using.
Okay. So when we're transforming the basis, we're not actually touching the y. Y is still keep it as that thing.
I think what you're saying is right. I'm not completely sure. There's multiple possible ways of interpreting what you just said. Okay, other questions about this? Okay, so let me go on to an application. Here's an example of using these things.
And one more question.
Yeah.
How close are those to the classical analogs, those last two results?
They're very, very close. So I don't know too much about the classical versions of these. But basically, these are the GF4 linear programming maps. So you have the same kind of thing for GF4. So I think there's also analogs of these for higher dimensions. And you see this 3 showing up there. That has to be, obviously, increased to the appropriate number of errors. So it's d squared minus 1. And I guess the 2 to the n, well, you change those also. Okay. So application. So in one of the earlier problem sets, I asked you to prove that there was no 3-1-2 stabilizer code. It turns out there's actually no code of those parameters, quantum error correcting code at all for qubits. And the way to show that is using these linear programming maps. So since it's a general code, we write it this way, remember. So the round brackets indicate that it doesn't have to be stabilizer code. 3 is the number of qubits. 2 is the number of dimensions in the code, right? So it's 1 encoded qubit, 2 is the distance here. So if you apply, say, this quantum singleton bound, well, then you'd think things were okay. Because distance 2 times d minus 1 is 2, and n minus k, 3 minus 1, that's also 2. Okay, so it does satisfy the quantum singleton bound, so it might be possible. But it turns out it's actually not. In the case of stabilizer code, there were these commutativity constraints that prohibited that. But in the general case, well, you might think maybe you could get around that somehow. Turns out you can't. So how do we see that? Well, so what does the McWilliams identity say? It says if we have this polynomial b of x, we're going to write out b0 plus b1x, plus b2 x squared, plus b3 x cubed. So you only have to go up to x cubed because there's 3 things here. Well, it says that this is equal to 1/4 1 plus 3 x cubed a 1 minus x over 1 plus 3 x. So 1/4 because we have big K is 2 here, 2 to the n is 8, so 2 over 8 is 4, or 1/4. So this is equal to 1/4 times, well, so we expand A. So we have the constant term A0, so it's 1 plus 3x cubed A0. For the linear term in A, we have A1 times just one version of this. So the 1 plus 3x cubed cancels out one of these 1 plus 3x's. So we have 1 plus 3x squared times 1 minus x times a1 plus 1 plus 3x times 1 minus x squared times a2 plus 1 minus x cubed times a3. Okay? And so if you then equate the, so you look at powers of x and you equate them from here to here. Okay? So if you look at the constant term here, well, constant term up here is b0. Let me multiply 3 by this 4. So we get, need a little more space. So we get 4b0 is equal to, well, so what's the constant term here? That's 1, a0, plus the constant term here is 1 squared times 1, a1, and so on. This is 1 again, a1. Right? And so if you do all the arithmetic, you find this, the other equations. Okay, so now let's start applying the other constraints. So what do we have? Well, we know that, that b0 is equal to 1, so this is equal to 4, and a0 is equal to 1. So that allows us to get rid of these a0s. Right? So this equation, then, is a1 plus a2 plus a3 is equal to 3. Okay. And we also know that the ais are greater than or equal to 0. We'll get to that in a minute. Next thing we know is that b1 is equal to a1, right? Because this is a distance 2 code that we're looking for. So applying that to here, well, we plug in b1 for a1, can subtract it out, and we get a1 plus a2 minus 3a3 has to equal minus 9. Okay? Find this equation, well, it's distance 2 code, so we don't know that a2 and b2 are equal, but we do know that b2 is greater than or equal to a2. So what does it tell us? Well, it tells us that this thing is greater than or equal to 4b2. So it's subtracting out the 4b, the 4, sorry, greater than or equal to 4a2. So subtracting that out, we get 3a1 minus 9a2 plus 3a3 is greater than or equal to minus 27. I guess there's a factor of 3 you can take out of there, but not going to need to. And this one, similarly, we have b3 is greater than or equal to a3. And so that tells us minus 9a1 plus 3a2. So this thing is greater than or equal to 4a3. Subtract that and we get minus 5a3. That has to also be greater than or equal to minus 27. Okay? So let's focus on these two equations. Since we know the ais are greater than or equal to 0, this is obviously pretty constraining, right? And comparing with this one, well, you can subtract them out, and you see that A3 has to equal 3. Find this here. So A3 has equal to 3, and A1 and A2 have to both be equal to 0, right? Because otherwise, you can never get this minus 9 here and this 3 up here. OK, so that actually has totally constrained the A's. We already know that A0 is equal to 1. So we have the weighted numerator is equal to 1 plus 3x cubed. And if you plug in into these two equations, you'll find that they're both satisfied. Okay? So if we're just using quantum equivalence identity, we'd say, well, okay, we do have a solution. So this is where the quantum shadow enumerator comes in, of course. Well, so the quantum shadow enumerator is going to be pretty similar, right, to these equations. But the difference is that instead of these 1 minus x's, it has x minus 1's. So in like for A2, that's not going to matter, because x minus 1 squared is equal to 1 minus x squared. But for A1, for A3, it will. It'll give us a minus sign. So basically, we'll have these same equations, but with minus signs, or relative minus signs for the odd things. So in particular, this first equation says that 4x0 is equal to 1 minus a1 plus a2 minus a3. Okay? But we know that a1 and a2 are equal to 0, and a3 is equal to 3. So this is equal to minus 2. So this would be telling us that S0 is minus a half. But we know it's not possible since the SIs are greater than or equal to 0. Okay? So we know that it's not possible to satisfy both the quantum Williams identity and these constraints on the quantum shadow enumerator for a 3-2-2 code. And therefore, none can exist. Okay? So you see how to use these things? So obviously, as you get to bigger, I mean, you can go up to 4, maybe 5 by hand, but much above that, you're definitely going to want to enlist a computer to actually try to solve these things. But people have, and there's some tables of quantum codes out there that use these quantum Williams identity, quantum shadow enumerator, to set reasonable bounds on what codes can exist. In some cases, we know how to achieve those bounds. In some cases, we don't. These things don't encapsulate everything about a code. But maybe that you can satisfy these constraints and still can't find the code. But you work with what tools you have. Finding good bounds on codes is one of the big research topics, perennial research topics in classical coding theory. Just like going the other way and actually finding codes. Questions? You're all shell-shocked. So I didn't prove any of this stuff. The proofs of these are more complicated than the proofs I've already shown you. So I didn't really want to do them, since this is a more advanced topic. But I think it's good to have these tools available, or at least know that they're available. And I've given you some practice with them on the problem set. Yeah?
Is there an easy way to show them? Kind of like, what's the attack on the quantum Williams identity? That seems like a non-trivial thing to prove.
I have to look it up to remember exactly. It's not actually that bad. The thing is that when you expand these equations, you always get the same formulas showing up. These things called the Krafcek polynomials. Let me see. So what's the key step? I can remember that. So I think it's roughly what I said, that when you expand pi as a sum of poly matrices, you get the coefficients of that expansion are the trace p pi's. And if you expand it, you also get something interesting from the thing that appears in bj, the trace p pi p pi. And so you set up some relationship between those. I think in the end it's not all that hard. I mean, it requires a little bit of work. I don't remember. I haven't looked at it for a while.
So then in the classical case, that's not the equation?
No. So in the classical case, there's no 3.
Which is 1 plus x.
Yeah. So these are the formulas for the GF4 classical case. Okay?
These will be the...
With the free. Oh, except the 2 to the n's are then different because you have the space of possibilities is different. Although I'm not sure that actually matters for satisfying these constraints. It matters also. Like, I'm letting it equal to the actual weight. Okay. Then maybe that's enough about bounds. So let me start on the next topic. Okay, so my next topic that I'd like to talk about is higher dimensional codes. So I've referred to them a couple of times during this lecture. And of course, you can do all kinds of the same things as before. The quantum error correction conditions, you don't even have to change them. I mean, they didn't make any explicit reference to the dimensionality of your things, right? You just had errors, which could be anything. And states, which are your code words. But stabilizer codes do make explicit reference to the poly group, which is a qubit-based thing. So the first thing we're going to do, well, really, the only thing we're going to do is think about higher dimensional stabilizer codes. Okay. So let's consider d-dimensional registers. Call qubits, and let's only consider the d greater than 2 case. So first let's think of the 1 qubit polygroup, And that's the set omega to the A, x to the B, z to the C. Where omega is the dth root of unity, e to the 2 pi pi over d. X, well, x is adding 1 mod d. So xj is equal to j plus 1. And so x, d minus 1 is going to be 0 then. And z is going to be a phase gate. So it's going to take j to omega to the j times j. Okay? So if you look at this, you'll see it doesn't exactly generalize the qubit polygroup, right? Because this is a d3 of unity. Whereas for qubits, we had not just plus the square roots of unity are plus or minus 1, but the polygroup was plus or minus 1 times x and z, x, y, and z, or plus or minus I times x, y, and z, which is a fourth root of unity. And the reason for that is that there's some weird thing that happens in even dimensions. So sometimes in even dimensions, it might be helpful to have P1 be things generated by the square root of omega. And that's what we actually want to do for the qubit case, or at least that's what I've been doing. But actually, in the qubit case, you can also let the polygroup be plus or minus 1 x times z, and a bunch of things work. The problem is that then when you go to the Clipper group, these weird eyes show up again, so you can't really get rid of them altogether. But pretty soon, I'm going to be specializing to primes, prime dimensions, and since d is greater than 2, that means I don't have to deal with the odd case. So let's just use this P. And so the n qubit polygroup is just kind of the obvious thing. Is it's the tensor product of n p1s. So in other words, it's omega to the A, and then x to the B1, z to the C1 tensor, x to the B2, z to the C2, and so on. Okay, everyone understand that definition? Okay, so let's look at some properties of that. So first of all, well, now that we have these factors of omega, things don't necessarily commute or anti-commute. They omega commute. You get some power of omega when you move things past each other. And in particular, if you calculate that, you'll find that xz is equal to omega inverse zx. And if you take two more general elements of the polygroup, x to the a, z to the b, and multiply it by x to the c, z to the d, well, you'll get omega to the bc times x to the a plus z, c, z to the b plus d, which if you then multiply the other way, you get omega to the bc minus ad times x to the c, z to the d, x to the a, z to the b. Okay? So this is the factor, the power of omega that you get by moving these two things past each other. So one other thing that's different in this case is that it matters which way you're doing it, right? So before, it mattered whichever way you did it, you know, minus sign is the same. But in this case, there's a difference between omega and minus omega, or omega and omega inverse, which is showing up in the difference of sign here. Okay, so we can do the same things we did before, So we can we have a vector representation. Again, of length 2n. And so if we write it this way, this would be, you know, P is x to the a1, z to the b1, x to the an, z to the bn. Right, so that's straightforward, just as we did for the binary case. And the commutation is now dependent on this thing, which is a symplectic inner product. And again, you may remember I said before that, well, why wouldn't there a minus sign? If you're familiar with symplectic inner products, you might be wondering where the minus sign is in the binary case. Well, here it is. It only shows up in the bidirectional case. In particular, P and Q commute if and only if the symplectic inner product is zero. And otherwise, they require a sign, a phase, rather, that's given by this. At least you'll be able to see the top half of the board. Okay. So next thing I wanted to point out is, so what is this weird thing that's happening in even dimensions? So we can see it, well, first of all, if we take x to the dth power, or z to the dth power, we obviously get the identity, right? Because adding 1 modulo d times just gets us back where we started. And omega to the d is equal to 1. So omega to the jd is certainly 1. So these are not doing anything. But if we take a different element to the dth power, well, then weird things can happen. Well, so what do we get? We get x to the a, z to the b, x to the a, z to the b, x to the a, z to the b. So if we move z to the b all the way to the right, we have to move it through x to the a d minus 1 times. And each time we do that, we get a factor of omega to the a b. And then the next z to the b, we have to move it past d minus 2 x's. Again, getting a factor of omega to the a b each time. And so on until we get to the rightmost one, which we don't have to move at all. And this. And then we have all the x's on the left. So we have x to the a, b, z to the b, d. and all the z's on the right. Okay, of course, this is equal to 1, and this is equal to 1. But this is not necessarily equal to 1. Well, what is it equal to? Well, this is omega to the ab. So if you do this sum, you get d times d minus 1 over 2. Okay, so in the case where d is odd, then this d minus 1 is even, and d minus 1 over 2 is an integer. And so we have omega to the d times an integer, and it is equal to 1. But in the case where d is even, then this doesn't have to be 1. If you square it again, you will get 1. But when d is even, then we have an a, if a and b and d minus 1 are all odd, then we have d over 2 times an odd number, right? And omega to the d over 2 doesn't need to be equal to, I mean, so in that case, I mean, it times an odd number, it won't be equal to 1. It'll be equal to minus 1. Okay, so that's the weird thing, and that's why we sometimes want to use a square root of omega. We have this omega to the 1/2 going up here. Okay? So what else? Well, so as before, Pn spans the d to the n by d to the n matrices. So we can use it as an error basis. So now, in the remaining 0 minutes of the class, let me just introduce stabilizer codes for these higher dimensional things. And it's really very easy, given what we've defined as kind of the most obvious version of stabilizer codes for the qubit case. You just take everything and replace the polygroup by this generalized polygroup. But to do this, let me, but that's not true, in fact, for general dimensions. So let's specialize to d being prime. And again, greater than 2. So it's the odd primes. So then we have this theorem, which is the obvious analog of the qubit case. So let S be an abelian subgroup. Pn. So in the qubit case, I had to say that minus 1 was not an element of the stabilizer. This time I don't. And that's, again, this annoying factor of a half that shows up in the qubit case and not in the higher dimensional case. So this is one way the higher dimensional case is simpler. So let T of S, as before, be the code space set of psi such that m psi equals psi for all S. So so S has R generators, and the size of S is equal to P to the R, generalizing the 2 to the R from before. And the dimension of T of S is equal to P to the N minus R. In other words, the number of encoded qubits is N minus R. So this is one of the things that we had to go to prime dimension for. If you go to a composite dimension, then you could have a abelian subgroup whose generators are things that don't have maximal order. So that might have an order that's, instead of being P, it could, or instead of being D, it could be some factor of D. And in that case, you can have kind of weird things happening with the size of this encoded subspace. And it's hard, in general, to predict, given an arbitrary group, what's going on. So there is a way to go to prime powers and start talking about these things, but one of the easiest ways to do that is just to create a power of a prime. You know, so if D is P to the S, then just treat it as S Q dicks, each of size P. Okay, and then you can use this polygraph. To do anything more sophisticated than that requires some more elaborate finite field machinery, which I don't think I want to introduce in the class. Okay. And then, of course, we can do the same thing to talk about distance. We can look at N of S, defined the same way, a set of P and P is an N, such that PM is MP for all M and S. So in other words, P commutes with everything in the stabilizer. And we'll let D be the minimum weight of P over P and N of S. N of S minus S. Right, as before. So then T of S, as before, has distance D. And what I mean by distance here is that we're treating each of the registers as a separate thing. So, for instance, distance d corrects d minus 1 erasures of these q dicks. Okay, so we're treating them as kind of indivisible units. So we have terminology. We say this code is nkd. But now people have put a subscript down here to indicate that it's acting in p dimensions. Okay? Okay, so that's it for today. Next week, I'll give some examples of higher dimensional codes. Maybe say some stuff about the Clifford group in higher dimensions, and then we'll move on to start talking about fault tolerance. Okay? Before I dismiss, does anyone have quick questions about this? Okay, then go your merry ways. If you have interest.